Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast, covering emerging topics and challenges in the fields of probiotics, prebiotics, synbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. This is the podcast of the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, known as ISAP, a nonprofit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of these fields. Check us out at www.isapscience.org. I'm Dr. Mary Ellen Sanders, ISAP's Executive Science Officer. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hello, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Daniel Tancredi.
Our guest today is Gregor Reed. Gregor, I've described already as a bit of a hero of mine. And Gregor, I hope you don't mind me using that characterization. You've been a real founding scientist in the whole field of probiotics. You're a very serious scientist, but I don't think you take yourself very seriously. Can I describe you as that? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I'm just surprised I would be your hero given the incredible work that you've done as a scientist. So I don't think I'd like to see myself as a hero of anybody, but I've certainly tried my best to contribute with my life and try to make a difference. And so if I have done that, then that's been great.
But I think the second part of that, that addresses the part of being a serious scientist, which I think is absolutely true. But I think, you know, you bring a humor to it as well. And I know it's hard to react to a comment like that, but do you deliberately use humor as a tool to educate, or do you think it's just your natural disposition?
I think it's natural. I was once told by someone who kind of analyzes people that Scottish people have two sides to them, of this very serious side and this crazy side. And when the balance goes wrong, you get in trouble. I think I do have a very serious side, but also I think humor is vitally important. And when you give a talk, you really are trying to entertain people, not just give them information. And when people are entertained, they take more of the information in. And so I like to have people have fun, because there's nothing worse than going to a talk and then coming away, so it was a great talk, but it was boring as hell, or it wasn't fun. So I have enjoyed doing that, and I think it's important.
You know, your papers have been cited. I looked it up this morning. You've been cited over 50,000 times, which is a tremendous contribution. But what first attracted you to this whole field of probiotics? How did you get into it?
I had a friend once who can read PAMs, and he looked at my PAM and he said, you know, you have a point in this PAM that suddenly goes a different direction. And he said, just as well, because you live longer. But I think there was a point in my life where you take the opportunities as it comes. And so I had gone to New Zealand, did my PhD. That itself was a very proactive step in my, I was written up in the local newspaper as if I was going to the other end of the world and might never come back. And then when I went to Canada, it was the same thing. I wanted to experience that. And I had an opportunity to set up a project on infectious disease. I was based in Calgary, but set it up in Halifax, and then set another project in Toronto with Andy Bruce. And when I met Andy Bruce, he's an amazing person. He was the top urologist in Canada. He's from Aberdeen. That's my football team. In fact, he lived on the street that I stayed in the first time I went to see Aberdeen. So we really hit it off. And it was his idea, not mine, his idea that lactobacilli played a role in women's health, because in 1973, he published a paper that those that had recurrent urinary tract infection had E. coli in the vagina and the perineum, and those that didn't had lactobacilli. And so everybody, and if you look back in history, they went back and they tried to get vaccines against E. coli. And he said, no, why are these lactobacilli there and what are they doing? So because of that, I joined his lab. Basically, I called up Calgary and said, I know I've only been a postdoc in Calgary for a month, but do you mind if I move to Toronto? And Bill Costin, who is a wonderful guy, said, yes, and we'll pay you for 2 years. So it was a great opportunity to work for scientists, but in a hospital facility with a urologist who really had a vision for what microbes might be doing for the health of women. So he really gets the credit for that. And then the rest is history. I started working on lactobacilli.
Gregor, there's kind of two bits of history that I'd like to kind of touch on, going backward a little bit to Bill Costerston's and his work, kind of really making people understand that cystic fibrosis and other kinds of infections, like 80% of that is really a property of the biofilms and slime. And then going forward, when you kind of extended that work and the really remarkable contribution you had toward figuring out how to deliver an intervention that could address the urinary tract infections. Can you talk a little bit about the influence that Costerston's work had on you? I know you were working in his lab, but as you just described, you then went to Andy's lab. And then also kind of how you thought that it might work, that you could deliver an intervention orally.
I think there's a number of lessons, Dan, for younger people to learn from this too. You have to remember that the ideas were completely crazy. People right. literally stopped us in the hallway in Toronto General Hospital and thought we were off our heads. And we didn't get funding. You know, you applied to the Medical Research Council. They just laughed. One comment from a reviewer said, "Why are you doing this? We have antibiotics." And Bill Costerton was very well funded, but people really didn't believe in biofilms back then. So I guess for younger people, it's follow what you feel, what you believe in, where you see something that is maybe not going to be well accepted, but you can see that there's something to it. And I really felt that biofilms were a role. In fact, we studied a lot of things like catheters and showed the biofilms were present in a lot of places. And then when you have a biofilm, how do you integrate, how do you change that biofilm? And so that gets you thinking about what lactobacilli might do to get into that biofilm or change it. So Bill had quite an influence on me as a person. He was a wonderful speaker. He actually used to be a Baptist minister. And so when he gave a talk, the audience were just silent, and he really had them. And so I learned about talks and also about just thinking outside the box. So he influenced me in different ways. The other thing that taught me was I went to work with a surgeon. And again, that was just not accepted. That meant you were a failed scientist. And why would you go and be a slave for a surgeon? I didn't see it that way. I saw it as here's an opportunity to be in literally an operating room. I'd go into the operating room with Andy Bruce and talk about the patient, talk about the conditions, and then try and think of ways that you can, as a scientist, do experiments to help that patient. And that was really powerful for me. Again, it was a totally different track in terms of academics. I was supposed to be a professor, go to the Department of Microbiology at the University of Toronto or somewhere like that. And I said, no, I want to be right in where the patient is. And so I think
that's remarkable, because now, you know, I have surgeons as mentors, and the way that they understand how to address those infections is it is the biofilm. Like seeing how an antibiotic will take out a bacteria in free culture isn't really relevant. You need to understand how to take it out with all that slime protecting that. You know,
but also at that time, you know, the drug reps would come into Andy Bruce's office and they'd say, well, we've got a new antibiotic. So it was norfloxacin, and then it was ciprofloxacin, and then it was tamiflofloxacin. And so there's two things we did. One was we studied them, but secondly, we used the money to continue our work on lactobacilli. And then you realize, just a minute, you're carpet bombing this area. You're not helping restore what that patient should see as normal. And so again, it taught us that the approach, and my view is all wrong, not to say you don't need antibiotics, you absolutely need them because it you know, cures UTI, for example. We should be thinking beyond that rather than, it was very narrow-minded to think you just take an antibiotic and the situation is solved. And many of these patients then had a yeast infection afterwards. And so you're getting this cycle of infection and not really helping them resolve it. And we saw a lot, I mean, I wasn't a physician, but I saw a lot of patients who were deeply, deeply traumatized mentally because it changes everything. They're in pain all the time, that they can't have a sexual relationship. And so you saw the life changes because you work with a physician. And I think that drove me on, and I think it would drive other people to say, no, I'm going to try and do something about this. Now, whether you succeed in your career, it doesn't matter so much. At least you tried. But that had a big influence on me.
And Gregor, in a, I suppose, in a mature field of research, as probiotics are now, and particularly probiotics for UTI, you'd expect some kind of a gradual movement from observation, such as you described, lactobacilli rather than E. coli in a healthy vagina. You'd hope to move towards mechanism and then towards better selection based on mechanistic insights. Do you think that's happened in that field?
Probably not. To be honest, we used to go to the American Urological Association meeting, and there was about four or five people that studied infection and 10,000 that studied cancers and other things. And out of the four, I was the only one doing this. And then David Euling was, he sort of played around with it a little bit. But unless you get people to get interested in it, then it's very difficult to, I mean, ideally you'd have a lab that would just look at mechanisms, or you'd have another lab that looked at application. But if you don't have the people that are working in that field, and that came actually back to urologists don't get much money for treating UTI. They get, they're surgeons, so they want to operate. And so very few of them were interested in something that was really not surgical and didn't have much option in terms of treatment. They couldn't offer much to patients. Now, there have been some changes. There's one expert in Ottawa that's interested in UTI. There's Curtis Nicol made a career out of prostatitis research, which again was off to the side of normal. So the answer to your question, no, I don't think there has been. And the other issue was, I hate to sound like I'm sort of complaining all the time, but the granting councils were not funding any of this. And you need to get them, maybe I wasn't writing good enough grants, but you need to get them to say, wait a minute, supposing lactobacilli does have a role here, let's fund this. And so if there's no funding at the science level, you're not getting young people to come in and set up the lab to become a probiotic expert and look at all these mechanisms. And so I think it's a dysfunctional system that has held it back. But I would agree with you, it's not gone anywhere near as far as it should have. We tried to get a company calling to do a clinical trial where you give this intravaginally, and the company said, no, it's too expensive, and then it becomes a drug, and so we're not going to do it. But I think intravaginal administration would have been a very useful thing to have done, and to find out whether it works or not, because that would be almost the perfect challenge, because you're saying that that's where the nidus of infection is.
Yeah. I think, I mean, what I really like about probiotics is they're a kind of an ecological approach to an ecological problem, if you know what I'm saying. I mean, the ecology of, you know, of the urinary tract has gone awry. And to go in and just kind of smash it with further antibiotics, okay, it might give you short-term relief, but it seems obvious that the thing she was trying to restore the ecosystem through taking advantage of the natural immune competence of the organ and, of course, the contribution of the microbiome. But I think you're right. I think we're failing to get that message across.
Well, see, the thing that totally astounded me is the number of women that suffer from not only urinary tract infection, but vaginal infection. It's astronomical. And if this was a male problem, we would have solved it a while ago. And so those infections are kind of under the radar, and many women suffer in silence, to be honest. And so I think it's a great shame. In fact, I knew one scientist in Manitoba who was a woman, infectious disease. She wanted to study this, and she never got any grant funding. And don't ask me why. And she should have. And so fundamentally, and then you look at drug companies, well, they're used to bringing out an antibiotic because they can, it's a chemical. But when you look at biologics or things that, as you say, interfere with an ecosystem, it's not in their lead. They don't know what to do with it. And so therefore you need to almost bring ecologists into these drug companies and start to think differently about how you approach a problem, because it's an ecological problem. It's not one E. coli, wipe it out and you've solved it. You haven't solved it.
One of the things you kind of pointed out, Gregor, is that it's not the species, you know, it's functionally what do you need to happen? And I wonder, you know, you have a business background also, you got an MBA. Do you think things are kind of set up as the way that they need to be, if you need to make a more ecological type intervention, like do something that's not bringing in a specific strain that the company could have a proprietary interest in, but more do something more holistic like you and Colin are talking about.
Yeah.
Are the incentives in place right now for businesses to pursue those type of interventions? And
I think the environment is now probably better than it's ever been. You have to look back at when we were doing this. We would go to the drug companies, and they didn't have anyone in place that could think along these lines. So unless you change that system, then it's going to be very difficult to bring in these concepts. And they would say, if we can't patent it, we're not going to bring a product out. And Coca-Cola never patented Coke. They kept it as a trade secret. You can make lots of money if you don't necessarily patent it. And so I think the change now is that there's a lot of smaller companies, startup companies, that are really trying to do things differently. And there will be a place for them, in my view. They'll have challenges. And M. Allen Virko's 33 bacterial strains that were a replacement for FMT, she's had challenges with that. But I think it will happen. I think because these patients are not being helped, and there's millions of them.
And your passion for this unmet need of this, female specific or largely female unmet need is obvious. But you have a passion as well, I think, in another area, which is Africa. Can you say something about your passion for making a difference there?
My father was born in Durban, and his dad had gone out to help the railway system way, way back. And he only lived there for a few years, but he had an uncle that lived there all his life. And when I did my PhD in New Zealand, I decided to come back to Britain and then Canada through Africa. So I went to South Africa, and then I went to Kenya. And I think the Kenyan experience was quite had an effect on me, because 2 months after I was in a marketplace, there was a coup in Kenya, and about 200 people died where I'd been standing. And the poverty just struck me. And also, being a white person, it felt like I was in their country. And so it made me think of, well, it'd be nice to help them, but we can't bring my solution to them. We have to help them get a solution. So when Stephen Lewis, who was the best Canadian prime minister we never had, he was the UN ambassador to AIDS in Africa. He made a plea in Canada to help with the HIV crisis. And a manager of housing called Bob Goff, who's a very passionate guy, he was in the audience. And so he said, yes, we are a university with thousands of students. We must be able to do something. And he got people together. And for whatever, there's different reasons why I was included. But I said, look, we have to do something that gives them the tools, not waiting for a plane to arrive. And so I said, why don't we teach them how to make probiotic yogurt? And it turned out that Shari Hekmat was a nutrition scientist who had just been recruited. She was originally from Iran, and she knew how to make yogurt. And so I said to her, why don't you do that? And so one thing led to another. It was really a feeling of, I'd like to help people that will never be able to afford good medical care, drugs, and that. And also the HIV crisis at the time was a disaster. And probiotics were never going to cure AIDS, but many of the people who even eventually got antiretrovirals also had diarrhea. So there was a lot of gut issues that went with HIV. And when you're in the middle of that and you see one of the women who set up the first kitchen, she had 11 kids. Her husband died of HIV. She had 2 adopted kids. So there's a woman with 13 kids trying to make a difference. You can't help but want to do something to help them. And I've always even said to ISAT, it would be worth a delegation of ISAT people to go to Uganda and Tanzania and see the community kitchens that have been set up, not because you're necessarily going to fund a project, but because I think it gives you a different perspective on life. So the passion came from trying to help, but really the people that made the difference is not me. It's Bob Goff, it's the people who send students out, it's the women in those communities that are unbelievable. So, I think it was something that was needed, and I'm glad that we can make a contribution to it.
Yeah, I was struck, for a young person coming into science and doing their PhD, doing their postdoc, many of the examples you gave of how things changed in your career involved serendipity, right place, right time kind of things, but they also involved you being proactive and contacting people, saying, I want to do this, I want to help. How would you advise young people in science who really want to make a difference? Not just publish papers in great journals, which we all want to do because we're trained to do that, but really make a difference.
I think there's probably a number of ways. I think part of it depends on whose lab you go into and the environment in that lab and the types of people that you connect with, because some people really do walk the talk and some people just are not interested in that. And that's fine because, you know, they'll do great science and there's a place for everybody. But I think if you really want to make a difference, you have to look at what is that your passion? Is it because your brother has Crohn's disease? Is it because your mother died of breast cancer? Is it, what is it that makes you almost unstoppable? One of my students, Brendan Daisley, who is the best student I've had, and he's wonderful. He had been training and had been taking lots of protein to try and get fit. And he ended up with mercury poisoning. And it's the reason that he stopped studying what he was doing. He came to Western and he went onto a project with me on mercury poisoning. That's an example of his own personal journey that then drove him to try and make a difference and ended up working on pesticides and honeybees, the same type of concept. So I think you have to have that passion. I think you have to have the right environment, which I certainly had with working with a clinician. I'm a big proponent of working with other people. You have to know yourself what you're good at, and then you have the right people that help you in that direction.
But you kind of need partnership, like you need input from that company. Can you speak a little bit about making kind of international impacts?
Yeah, so the reason we chose this group of mamas, we call them yogurt mamas, the first group was because a colleague from Kenya knew this woman's organization and she went to them. It was called Kivalini. Kivalini said, yes, we try and help women and become entrepreneurs and set up small businesses. And we do have a group of women who might want to do this. So you need to have those connections, because at the end of the day, these women made it work despite so many challenges. So you definitely need to have the right people on the ground if you're working in another country.
And Gregor, I'd like to, I think we're going to wrap up now, but I'd like to give you the last word. And it can be something about ISAP. It could be something about the field. Do you have anything that you'd like to say to our listeners, you know, from a legacy point of view? What did you learn that you would love to transfer onto other people?
I would say there's two things, one for ISAP and one for industry. But I'm a great believer, if you're going to lead an organization, that you should have some goals that you then work through the organization. So for me, the Students and Fellows Association, I really felt there was a place for that. And so that was one of the things that I did as a president. I think everyone has an opportunity to make a difference. And I don't think enough of us push it and do it, right? And I really urge people to take advantage of a wonderful opportunity that they have in organizations like ISAP. The second thing is really for industry. And, you know, there's all these sayings about if you do the same thing that you did 30 years ago, then you're not going to make a difference. I see it in the companies, the sort of spinning off and coming up and that are new, that these big companies are not flexible enough. They need to change the way they see themselves and how they go about things, because it shouldn't take 30 years to be working on ecosystems and the types of things we talked about and bring in new approaches to how you do things. And they have huge resources, but I visited lots of companies that were absolutely stuck in these little boxes and were almost not allowed to go outside them. It's very difficult to make a difference unless you have a way to apply what it is you've found scientifically. And that's why we need industry partners. And I think without them, then we're going to struggle. And obviously regulatory you need as well, because they've been pretty inflexible in approving things like probiotics. And so the system I'd like to see change. And I think the field is going to expand hugely. I just published a paper that a colleague was working on coral probiotics. I wouldn't have ever imagined in my life that you would give probiotics to coral. And so you're going to see it in plants and other parts of life. Because this is a microbial planet, we are microbial humans, and we have to start thinking of them for their benefits, not just the things that kill us.
Gregor, that was really wonderful. And your passion comes through, but also what I like is some of your frustration with, you know, we're not there yet, and maybe we'll never be there, but we can certainly get a lot farther than we are right now.
It takes people to fight, Colin.
Yeah.
And we can't stop fighting, because there's always going to be things that we need to achieve. And I think it's like a football match. You might be one down at halftime, but you can still win 2-1 in the end. And so I'd like to keep everyone fighting, and that way we'll make a difference. So thanks for your time.
It was great having you, Gregor. You're certainly somebody that if you're in a fight, you want to have Gregor on your side.
Well, I'm maybe not very big and strong, though. In fact, I was in Finland once with an Irish woman who was, we're walking along, and she was a black belt in karate. And I said, good, finally, I've got someone to protect me. So
great. Thank you, Gregor.
Okay.